This podcast is a part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com. Get ready, because the geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Proactionary. Proactionary? Is that a word?
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 115 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we had come to accept our inevitable death, but at the last moment are given a second chance, dodge the proverbial bullet, and celebrate this new lease on life by promptly becoming a grumpy old self-centered bastard who insults everyone around him.
Ah!
Because that's what we do. I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios tonight is Keir. How's it going, Keir?
I'm fantastic. I got a lot of extra room on either side of me right now, though.
Yeah, apparently Haley decided that it would be a good idea to go and, you know, visit sick children for the holidays or something. And, you know, so she's actually under the weather and doesn't have much of a voice. So we decided to just give her the night off.
But this week we wanted to take a look back at this season's character development for, you know, our title role, our 100% Rebel Time Lord, and examine his personal growth, his idiosyncrasies, and most importantly, you know, the critical role that his eyebrows have played in resolving this latest Cyberman threat. We've been talking about character arcs. We've been talking about the interaction of characters in this very critical season, as far as the way that both the viewing public and even the cast and crew have been going on about how tight and focused the direction of so many aspects of the show have been. And when it comes to the Doctor, whenever you've got a new Doctor, a new actor portraying the Doctor, the microscope has been focused, and we're now going to watch that development very carefully to see A, how he suits the role or personalizes the role, but B, what that means for where our title character is headed. So, you know, a lot of expectations placed on Peter Capaldi's shoulders, and rightfully so. You know, when you have an actor of that caliber, you're going to set the bar pretty high. But does that mean that it just becomes the Peter Capaldi show and the Doctor isn't really part of it? You're just sitting back and enjoying the power of the actor and not the role. So
with Matt Smith, we didn't have a huge character arc with him. He came in and he was this character of the Doctor, and that was pretty much how he was throughout the whole series. You know, he had his ups and downs and different things that happened, but there wasn't really a lot of development with him, I'd say.
Well, it was sort of established that he was looking for the affection and the love of family. You know, he wanted that sort of bond with those that he called important. And from his first arrival in the 11th hour, obviously when you've got young Amelia Pond there, you've got this opportunity to establish that great relationship with a child and nurture it throughout. And it just happens, because of wibbly wobbly timey wimeyness, that it all ends up coming around and yields the birthing of your wife. Hey! So, you know, that you've got your, you know, but as far as his personal journey, yeah, it is. It's very focused. You know, he's headed in this direction. He wants to make sure that he is the family man, and he attains that and maintains that. And the only times where his character stumbles are the times when he's apart from them, or trying to get back to them, or whatever right. The case may be.
You know, one of the theories that I've had on that is actually that, you know, he knew that this was his last regeneration, and he wanted to, you know, enjoy the last of his life, enjoy what he had left, basically. And he didn't want to spend his remaining years, however many they were, which turned out to be like centuries, focused on things that, focused on regrets and things that he couldn't change. And, so he just accepted them as part of his history and then, ignored them basically, or not ignored, but, just didn't worry about them too much. And then once he gets this newer generation, once he has a chance to reevaluate himself and he's got the time again, the first thing he does is say, okay, what kind of man am I now? And he starts to reevaluate himself and do things he didn't feel like he had the time to do before.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a great part that we can start from. We've got the good man, pursuit. Is happening, sometimes overtly. He sits down and has the pal conversation with Clara. There's times when you can tell that he's warring that through and worrying it within his mind. He's not sharing it with anyone. That's when he's often, filling his blackboards with the whether it be the hunt for Gallifrey or there could be other things that he was trying to work through. When he suddenly decides that he's going to start, pursuing his nightmares, figure. This is all very introspective work. So, or intrapersonal, as opposed to interpersonal, because his interpersonal skills are sadly lacking. I figured we had this down as one of our first points to kind of take through here. And this is the fact that we knew from the early descriptions before the series even started that we were going to be returning to a very, and this is a direct quote, a more alien doctor. We were going to be reminded of the fact that he is not human. If Matt Smith was going to great lengths to want to integrate and be part of a human family and we've discussed how the pattern of regenerations tends to go back and flip aspects that either saw their natural conclusion or didn't work correctly or proved to be a problem, so it gets corrected in the next regeneration or flipped entirely. That's what we've got here. I don't want to be cuddly. I don't want to be part of your family. I don't want to sit back with a bowl of popcorn and watch films on the couch.
Yeah.
So how does that fit into his path over this series? If we know that right from the jump, he's very alien, very disconnected, very disdainful towards other species, not just humans, but everything. Mm-hmm. How has that grown?
Well, I mean, it's the first real thing that we see is that, previously the Doctor was always the smartest person in any given continent, and he, he used that a lot to his advantage, but especially with Tennant and with a little bit less with Matt Smith, but just because he played it differently, it was always an endearing trait.
Charming.
Charming. Look how much smarter I am than everyone. Don't you love me for that? And with Capaldi, it was really, look how much smarter I am than you. Don't you feel inferior?
Mm-hmm. Putting brains.
Yeah. And so it was the same quality of the Doctor. He just had a different feel to it that really kind of set him apart from everything else. And that was one of those things that really did separate him from the beginning.
Well, and I'm going to set you up for your own insight on this because it's here in your notes, was the fact that this was not always being done because of the fact that he was just genuinely, that smug or just had that kind of, that seething undercurrent against anything else, but because when you pair that with the good man, bad man battle, within himself, there's a reason why he wants to keep everyone else at arm's length.
Well, yeah, because it really was a way to distance himself. It was a way to, give him that space and sometimes keep others out of danger, sometimes give him the time he needed to put things together. But it was a way to, to separate himself a little bit further, for whatever purpose that served.
Mm-hmm. Well, call that trope the grumpy old man down the block who chases the kids off of his lawn until the day comes when one of them actually, enters the house and realizes that he's just a sad old grandfather who misses his grandkids and wants to be loved and that kind of thing. But I think in this case, we're dealing with the fact that he's concerned about the fact that he may be a danger to those that he allows on the inside. Mm-hmm. So, but he's never going to express that because there's also a massive amount of, not pride or bravado, but there's an element to his character that does not want, you know, take the hugginess. That's the physical manifestation of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a hugger because that's, that hugs involve not only me allowing you to be close, but it expects something to be reciprocated. And I'm not sure if I'm safe enough to reciprocate that kind of affection because I don't know how genuine that sign of affection coming from me really may be. But he's never going to express that. He's never going to say, you know, he's not going to, you know, tip his cards and say, look, I'm dealing with this internal struggle. The closest he came was to have some of those conversations with Clara, but that came right before a big falling out.
Yeah.
Which just shut him down.
Pretty much, yeah.
So, yeah. Well, that segues then. If what is in his progression, and I don't even want to say necessarily progression. I'm going to use the word development because progression implies that necessarily something is getting better. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the case. And I don't even know in this particular instance with where the 12th Doctor is that he has progressed necessarily because as we've seen in final moments at the end of Death in Heaven, they're lying to each other to protect one another, mm-hmm. but lying to the extent where they are now moving worlds apart. Yeah. And is that necessarily progress? Has he bettered himself if that's the outcome?
Yeah, that's the question is like what a lot of the question behind that is what was the reason for that? You know, is he just responding to, you know, Clara pulling away? And is he, you know, is it one of those things like I know that you're going to be leaving, so I'm going to start treating you badly so that we can both, you know, you can leave and neither one of us feel as bad. You know, it makes it an easier thing. Or is it, you know, that they both had that thought of, I need to go my own way now. Mm. You know, so, but, you know, one of the things that we did see that kind of bled through into this character from previous iterations was like his reliance on the companion. You know, there were a lot of times where he tried to play down how important Clara was. There were times where he wanted to, you know, not belittle her, but, you know, not let her know how much she meant to him.
Sure.
You know, up to the point where the very end where she thought, you know, that he was ready to leave without her. And he said, no, look, this is how much you mean to me kind of thing. But that was really the first time that we'd seen that really expressed. But I mean, his reliance on Clara was something that did feed all the way through the series. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it was on two levels. There were times when his reliance upon her was just as a matter of steadying, or giving him the sounding board to his plans and machinations and mm-hmm. so forth. And there were times when he was actually physically incapable of protecting himself and she was there for him, whether he realized it or not, you know, take it even from deep breath, you know, physically, you know, immobilized, and is relying on, well, Clara and the Paternoster gang, to be there as his protector, especially as he comes to and he's clearly off his nut and going about it on his base instincts and his base instincts, even when he's just starting to get some control over his physical form. His brain is already in Doctor Analytical mode. You know, he's taking apart situations. You know, what is the question that needs to be asked? No, wrong. What is the question? You know, and that's when you boil him down and you take everything else away from him and take him completely out of his area of comfort. That's what he relies on. Logic, reason, observation, analysis, hypothesis, the scientific method.
Yeah.
That is the doctor. It is the scientific method. So, but the one thing that lacks is any sort of emotional conduit. So his reliance on Clara, in so many instances throughout until to the point where it finally starts to return to his character is that aspect of emotion. He tried to remain emotionless for so long, or to remain distanced or spiky or whatever adjective that you want to use.
Right.
And allow her to be that. She's my caretaker. She cares so I don't have to. I mean, they were handing it to us over and over and over again. But it was so true in the way that he was being portrayed and what they were allowing his character to feel or not feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that was one of the things that I enjoyed was that, you know, it was an aspect that was new, but at the same time, it was something that, you know, that was familiar to the Doctor. It was something that fit his character. Even though this was a new, you know, version of the character, it still fit. And that was something that I really did enjoy because it didn't seem like, oh, we're going so completely different. You're not even going to be able to recognize the Doctor anymore.
Mm. I think as you had noted, the idea of having the superior intellect, it would be very easy to use that as a point where, you know, it's a matter of just lack of patience with these lesser beings.
Yeah.
And the idea of the barrage of insults, you know, the very muted Malcolm Tucker nature of the Doctor, you know, and we were worried for a while that was going to become something that just made him completely unapproachable.
Yeah.
Or remove so much of the endearing qualities that we had established with the Doctor, even prior to, you know, to Eccleston and Tennant and so forth. But, you know, McCoy was the affable, adorable, you know, goofball wizard and so forth. And, you know, and even take it back to Colin Baker for all of his bravado and his braggadocio and so forth. It was enjoyable and charming because it was always done with that degree of bombacity that just made it enjoyable. You know, it was, you know, you kind of liked him because of the fact that he never flinched from it. And chased it all the way back the line. But with this, he was just cold. Cold to everyone, especially those that we knew, whether he realized it or not. These individuals like Vastra and Jenny and Clara and so forth, these are people that are supposed to matter to you.
Right.
And they deserve better. And if you don't do something about this, if he doesn't progress, you know, we're not only going to have an unenjoyable character, you know, the viewership is going to take it. The critics are going to tear into him, you know, and this was a huge gamble.
Well, and that was a lot of the complaints you heard early on about Capaldi was that, you know, people didn't like the way he was treating Claire. He was overly harsh and, you know, they didn't understand why he had to be so mean to her and things like that. And that was a genuine concern for some people.
Mm. Well, but then some things started to happen that showed that there were, maybe call it chinks in the armor, but there were softer spots amid all of these crags and cracks and so forth. And I think one of the first times I really started to see that was in Listen.
Yeah.
And you know exactly where I'm headed with this.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So it's when you take this, you know, this sour, you know, disgruntled, the old codger, and he suddenly has to come to the aid of a child. And you've got this polar opposites of the, you know, the bitterness of time that is happening. Oh, I've seen such things. And then there is the frailty and the innocence of the young. Who need and are looking for explanation or protection or or assurance. And so you look to your elders because they are the ones with the experience. They're the ones who know. They're the ones that can tell you what's what and what I need to be afraid of and what I can be sure of. And then all of a sudden you're putting that in the hands of this doctor.
Yeah. And he nailed it though. I mean, that was the thing is, you know, we all talked about how Matt Smith was a good doctor for kids, you know, and Matt Smith as a person really played into that. And he was always willing to sit down and talk with kids and things like that. He was very personable with the children. And then, you know, here we've got this doctor who has done absolutely nothing up to this point, but, you know, give us reasons to think that he just hates all of humanity. And then you set him next to a child and it was just amazing the change in his character, which was not out of character though.
No.
I mean, it made complete sense that he would sit down and just take the time to educate this kid and to, you know, help him through it and that kind of thing. And it added a new layer to the doctor that made you think there's a reason for all of this gruffness. There's a reason for all of the spikiness. But once you get past that, you know, there's another layer to him that really reminds you more of the previous iterations.
I think for all of the likability that Smith had across, you know, the various age demographics and things, the one thing that he never was able to really convey was any sort of paternal nature. It just, you know, it wasn't capable because either because of his youth or just because of his, you know, his character nature. Mm-hmm. What we suddenly get, when the doctor, you know, kneels down to talk to, you know, our young Pink, it is something that is, I think what struck me about it is it felt, it had the paternal nature to it, but it also had something that you see, veteran teachers are capable of doing. They don't talk down to children. Right. They talk to children. They have conversations with children as peers. Mm. And you'll see it time and time again. Children will rise to meet you. You know, they're fascinating, fascinating minds in that regard. And if you've got that happening on one level, you know, as the whole idea of, you know, what to be scared of. Do you think he's scared of you? No, he's not scared, you know, and that conversation goes on. So it's a very brilliant take because it's and from a writing perspective, you know, I give so much credit, you know, to when Moffat put this one together. Mm-hmm. And also, I think to a certain degree, McKinnon as the director for the way that he wanted this to be particularly shot. The flip side of it is we now have an aspect of the Doctor where you realize that he understands humans much better than we were giving him credit for previously. It's just that he was choosing not to have the interactions for some other reason yet to be fully aired.
Yeah.
But he knows humans and doesn't, not only knows humans, but he knows their youth, which is something very personal and oh, yeah. Very.
You can't say that about most, you know, adult humans.
Yeah. So I think, and that was just the first step, you know, we had more instances of it. You can tell that he has the usual kind of disdain for tweens and teenagers because of his dealings with Courtney, but, yeah. But that's going to be given. So what about, as far as other things where the Doctor has gone through some progression, actual progress, some things that have improved over the course of the series that we can point directly at?
Well, I mean, we've talked about the whole "Am I a good man" thing. You know, that was an underlying thing throughout the whole series. And, you know, at the very beginning, he was unsure. He was acting, you know, this specific way and trying to redeem himself, but not really sure how to do it. Not really sure if he was doing it well. And, you know, especially with Into the Dalek, where, you know, he made the decision to do the right thing and look how badly it ended up. And, you know, so there was constantly this, he was trying to find the balance of, you know, being a good man, but still getting results, which often didn't coincide.
Well, yeah. The thing I was trying to grapple with for a while was the fact that he was questioning this, that he was really sort of taking apart his motives and his methods. Mm-hmm. Coming into this regeneration. If he had full working knowledge, or by a certain point he sort of, you know, his faculties solidify to the point where he has his good working knowledge of his predecessors and his previous millennia of walking the universe. And now he's at the point where he is looking back at it all, and he's sort of laying his now 2,000-year diary or so in front of himself, and trying to determine where it balances on the moral scale. Mm-hmm. Is this something that is even fair for him to have to deal with when he's, you know, we're only, I'm not sure the total amount of time progression by the time we get to Into the Dalek. It's a very, I'm assuming this is a very short spin. Mm-hmm. But he has to deal with the observations that are handed to him, the third party observations handed to him about, you know, the assessment of his character. That if he had any sort of if he was sort of coming to terms to a certain degree about where his compassions lie or those things, uh-huh. and then has his legs cut out from under him by Rusty, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's necessarily something that I would label fair to the character. interesting for us as a viewer.
Yeah, no, very much so. I felt it was more, it was along the lines of something that, you know, it, like you said in Time Heist, where he tells Karabraxis, you know, you're, one day you're going to be old and you're going to be full of regret. And you think about all the time that, that he spent on Trenzalore waiting to die, basically. And that stuff had to be going through his head. Stuff had to be, you know, processing. And then he gets the chance to redeem himself. Well, that's going to be at the forefront of his mind. And so he's going to want to address this stuff. And it, I agree. He didn't have enough time to really wrap his head around everything before, you know, being subjected to the, you know, you're a good Dalek kind of thing. Mm. But, you know, at the same time, that's what builds the tension for us. That's what helps to submit that conflict in this character.
Right.
So that, you know, if he had enough time, then yes, he could have found that balance, but you have him think, oh, I'm going to do the right thing and I'm going to save this Dalek. And he gets his legs cut out from under him just, you know, instantly like, oh, that was a bad choice. You know, and so he starts to wrestle with that. And that's something that carries on through.
Right. Well, as I think what I kept noticing at the times was that, well, I think he was making what he felt to be progress in terms of getting the materials laid out for himself to assess his worth or his balance.
Mm-hmm.
When he is reminded of his disdain, his divine hatred, hatred. I mean, that's something where he's not only being credited for how pure his hatred for the Daleks are, but that it reaches a deification proportion.
Yeah.
That's, he's being honored by the very beings that he loathes so inherently.
Right.
That struggle was something that I think was rightfully placed as the linchpin to this series. And I'm glad that I'm extremely glad that it was a very introspective element to use as a primary theme throughout the series. More so than the relationship with Clara or anything on an interpersonal level.
Yeah.
Because we haven't had more than, you know, I try to think through Tennant's Dark Doctor days or the, you know, the handful of episodes where Smith and the Pons went off the rails and he had to do some soul searching and that sort of thing. They weren't given nearly the amount of hashing out to come to any kind of conclusions that allow us to say, you know what? We have had a main character for 50 years that we have followed through thick and thin and watched other characters come and go and watched him deal with these people around him come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen him deal with, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and things of that sort, you know, for call it what it will, for the Time War and such. And all of these different things. But we've never really given him the opportunity to look at himself and say, what have I done? And why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And I don't think we've necessarily gotten any great answers. You know, the conclusion that he gains in Death and Heaven is just the fact that I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing because whether it always works out correctly or not is what I believe to be the right thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he has completely figured out for himself what his goal is. He just knows right. that once he gets into the thick of things, he knows the choices that he makes and the paths that he chooses are done because he feels he's coming from the right place.
Yeah. He's learned that his instincts are usually, his heart is in the right place, and that is the thing that matters.
But that's not necessarily, that's reactionary.
Yeah.
That's once he gets into the midst of it. So now it's it still leaves out there the whole matter of what is he doing out there? Or is he the leaf in the wind? If he's come to that conclusion, that says something very different. And that changes one of the underpinnings of the show as far as I'm concerned. Because there's times when it kind of feels like that. You know, he throws a switch, leaves it at the TARDIS, goes off in the adventure, and whoop, wild hijinks ensue.
Yeah.
But it's not always that random.
Right. No, and that's true. Yeah, I think the I think that the main thing that he got out of this whole revelation that he came to was that when push comes to shove, it doesn't matter if he's good or bad. Yeah, like he's trying to be a good person. He's trying to be that, the positive version of himself. Mm-hmm. But when push comes to shove and something needs to be done, as long as he is doing something with the best, with the best intentions in mind or whatever, then that is the best thing that he can do. Mm. Yeah, there's no point in doing this whole, am I a good person? What would happen? Have I the right, kind of thing. As long as he trusts his instincts, as long as he does what he feels is best in his hearts, then that's going to be the best thing for everyone.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think another aspect of what we've been trying to figure out for Capaldi's interpretation of the Doctor and what they've done with handing him some space to manipulate and personalize the Doctor. We know that they wrote very specifically for him. Mm-hmm. Just as we knew that to a certain degree, they started writing Smith episodes very carefully for Smith's capabilities. But I think they were doing, in those instances, over those seasons, those were writing to his acting style, not necessarily what he was going to be able to accomplish with pushing the envelope for the character. They found a pattern for him. They found a sandbox that he was very adept in, and they started working within that. Here, I feel like that they knew they had an opportunity to move the Doctor forward in a direction that they may not have been fully prepared to describe. But they knew that they had an actor who was able to bring something inherently different to the character, or be able to play something into it that they had not had in quite some time. And they had a need, as Moffat had been saying in some of his interviews from a few months back, saying, we had become a formula. And while it was new and fresh to the viewing public, we knew very quickly the moment it becomes a recognizable formula, you've got to dump the whole box out and fill it up again. Well, here, I'm trying to determine, where do we go from this point now that we've seen how tumultuous dealing with this Doctor can be? Because either he is keeping you at arm's length for your own good, or keeping you at arm's length because he doesn't really know himself, or he's keeping you at arm's length because he knows himself and knows that it's best that you're not near him. That's a very different point for our Doctor now. There's, he's always wanted the companions. If he's gotten to a point now where he realizes that he believes himself to be that much of a danger, and he wants Clara to go off and live her life with Danny and do those things because that's best for her, then hell.
Well, I think that was something that we kind of saw wrapped up in the second half of the series, where it wasn't so much that he realized he was putting Clara in danger, like physically or anything like that. I think it was, especially with Flatline, that moment when, Claire's like, look, I was a good doctor. Admit that I was a good doctor. Admit that I did well being you. And, he tells her, yes, you're a fantastic doctor. Goodness had nothing to do with it. And he started to realize that his moral dilemma that he was going through, am I a good man or not, was wearing off on her, that she was beginning to become like him. And since he hadn't figured that out, that was something that he wanted to keep her distant from. He didn't want her to become him because he didn't know if he was the kind of person that was worth emulating. Mm. So he wanted better for her than he could offer at the time.
Yeah. Well, it's like the idea of, hearing your own voice on a recording or seeing yourself on a videotape or something of that sort, where you notice aspects of yourself that you weren't aware of. And when he sees her emulating him, and not only emulating him, but emulating some of the tough calls or some of the morally gray areas mm-hmm. that he has to deal with so often, it's an ice bucket moment for him. You started to kind of lay out the progression of our most modern doctors based on what was rattling through their heads on each transition point.
Yeah. And I mean, we kind of went through the whole process with all 12 doctors or all 11 doctors before the series started, of what kind of character aspects they were, that each regeneration embodied, that, you know, were leftovers from the previous, you know, with, you know, five having the whole, you know, look, I just met you, but, you know, come on my TARDIS kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Transitioning into the sixth doctor being very, you know, no, I don't want people around me kind of thing. It's too crowded. I need my space. Go away. Mm-hmm. You know, and those kind of things that, you know, not, I don't want to say flaws, but things that happened in one regeneration that helped to shape who they became next.
Right.
And so we, yeah, like Kira was saying, we, just to touch on some of the recent ones to kind of get the ball rolling, you know, we had the ninth doctor was a post-war vet who was trying to, you know, basically fit back into society, you know, trying to figure out where his role was now after the Time War.
Right. With everything fresh in his mind, with everything, you know, there's a certain point where coming right out of it, it's not even, guilt has not even set in yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't even have the opportunity to solidify in that regard. You're still dealing with just the shell shock aspect of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think he still has the affability to it. And there's times when Ninth Doctor is very endearing. He's charming. He's mm-hmm. fun. I mean, people give him so much guff for being, you know, the leather clad, you know, submarine commander kind of. But he really wasn't. I think one of the reasons why people kind of spin that on him is because they're comparing that with his successor.
Yeah. Who was the younger, hipper, you know, he wanted to be somebody that Rose could be with. And so he became someone younger who Rose could be with. You know, and then, you know, he understood the importance of having people around him. You know, when we first saw him, you know, yes, he saved Rose's life and then kicked her to the curb. He's like, nope, just go away, you know, stay out of danger kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he, through the course of the series, he understood, I need people with me. You know, how many times, you know, I mean, he brought on Captain Jack. You know, he took Rose. He had people that began to help him. He understood the importance of having friends. So 10 was a very friendly doctor. He made friends. He had them with him. And then through his travels, one person after another, he would make the friends and they would leave. He would make the friends and something horrible would happen to him. You know, and so he got to the end of his life and he realized, you know what? Friends are important, but friends come and go. What I need is a family.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about how dealing with circumstances, like when, you know, 12th Doctor is new within his shoes, you know, the body is still cooling, so to speak, and he's left to his base instincts. He's doing problem solving. You know, that's kind of that aspect mm-hmm. of it. The problem solving aspect, if that's the core of the Doctor, regardless of which iteration we're talking about. I look at the sequence, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, and look at the way that they do their problem solving. And that speaks volumes for their aura about them. Yeah, I'm getting very crystalline. But just, you know, walk with me on this. So, Ninth Doctor, his problem solving is still very battle hardened. Okay. A lot of yelling, a lot of confrontation, a lot of argument, a lot of very intense problem solving. You know, this is sleeves rolled up kind of in the thick of it. 10, when he's dealing with problem solving, it's very relying upon, wit. It's relying upon unpredictability or seeming unpredictability when he's actually got it figured out.
Yeah.
And he's had it planned out all along, but it's the whimsical nature of the solution, very RTD, you know, just kind of, you know, haha thing. I had this all along. That's why I did this and this and this. We get to 11 and the problem solving is done by gathering his strengths among him, whether that be the companions or the allies or what have you. It goes along with that family theme, you know, the idea of the blood is thicker than water kind of approach. So, if that's that sort of a pattern, and it goes along with where their personas are, because 9 is still dealing with repercussions. 10 wants to be liked. 11 wants to be loved. Mm-hmm. Where are we with 12?
Yeah, and that's the question. Is I'm still trying to figure out what the holdover is here. Like what sparked this kind of what sparked this kind of regeneration? And the thing that I keep coming back to is look at what happened to his family. You know, because they were ready to stay home. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Power of Three right before they wanted to stay home, and he was ready to let him be. And it was that addiction that, you know, one more trip. I just need one more. I just need my fix. So get it out of my system. And then he takes them on one more trip and look what happened. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, and then you see the same kind of thing with Clara, who, you know, over and over and over again, you see her sacrifice herself for him. And then you finally learn the reason why. And I think that kind of helped lead into this regeneration, like we were talking about, of, you know, wanting to keep people at arm's length. He understands how dangerous it is to be around him. He's had it pointed out to him countless times. So he's hesitant to let anyone be too close because he knows how dangerous that can be. Mm.
Well, here's what I'll throw out there then, just based on what we've been kind of assessing here. If 9 wanted to be back among society, mm-hmm. and there were times when that kept failing or it ended up becoming a bigger struggle because of what he'd bring along with it, you know, one of his longstanding nemeses would come back out of the woodwork and would make things miserable for the humans that he wanted to be integrated with. So mm-hmm. he to a certain degree, he was a source of that problem. Then he wants to be close with Rose, whether that's really, you know, spoken or not.
Yeah.
And because of the nature of who he is and the complexity of his existence and the complications that come along with all of his historical baggage and things, that fails. Well, handy doctor, notwithstanding.
Well, yeah.
With 11, he wants his family. He gets his family. He ends up losing his family.
Mm-hmm.
In each one of these instances, the point of failure is him.
Right.
So with 12, do we finally get to the point where he says that I know where the problem lies. Now I have to determine whether or not it's something that can even be remedied. Or is this just going to be the nature of who I am? And because I've walked these worlds for so long, and because I've seen all the things I've seen, and because I've made all the enemies that I've made, I can't be corrected. You know, is that the kind of introspection that he's dealing with at this point? And it passes through the good man, bad man discussion.
Yeah.
But it also goes along with, you know, as you were saying, am I anyone that I can safely be around? Is the reason why we've gotten this very standoffish or at times unsympathetic or just unapproachable or what have you, you know, name your descriptor for this doctor. Is mm-hmm. this because this is a physical manifestation in this regeneration of someone that needs to spend some time alone? Needs to.
Yeah. See, that's one of the things that I'm hoping that we get in subsequent series. I want more of this, the introspective journey that we're going on. Mm-hmm. Because we've learned what it means to be a companion of the Doctor. I mean, that's a great way that they have set this show up, as, you know, we're looking through the eyes of the companion. We understand what it means to be a companion of the Doctor and all the danger and excitement that comes with it. You know, we've seen the spectacles. We've seen how amazing and outstanding it can be. The thing that we haven't seen in a very long time is what it means to be the Doctor, you know, and what it means to be the last of your species when, you know, or to have been the last of your species and understand that you can find them again. You know, I want to see a lot more of this, the personal journey that he goes through.
Mm. I don't know if that necessarily means that we have to get any more of his backstory. I know that every once in a while when Moffat wants to stir up the public, he'll give us a young doctor in the cabin and that sort of thing. Or,
yeah.
Because it just in either incites or enrages or what have you. But that's not necessarily so much of what we need right now for him to deal with where he stands at the moment, because it's everything that he's come through, and it's where he is now, that either makes him your greatest ally or the greatest danger to be around. So
right.
If that's for him to determine. I don't know. Haley, what do you think? I just want to make sure she was still involved to a certain degree.
Right, yeah. what are some of the things that you're hoping that they go with in the future? What are some of the things that you would like to see from this doctor?
Well, I think because of the nature of his stature and his gravitas, mm-hmm. If we never get the full return to Gallifrey, if that does not become part of the dynamic again, where, mm-hmm. It's an accessible location, or that there's going to be some sort of regular interaction with the Time Lords or what have you, what I would love to see, and I think a certain degree of this is just because of the nature of what I know Capaldi is best at, which is the blistering rapid fire confrontations and the verbal volleys and those things that he just crushes, mm-hmm. Would be something along the lines of a Valyard kind of Trial of the Time Lord instance where he has to go toe to toe with intellectual battles with capable peers,
Okay.
I thought when we were starting to play the Master card again that we were going to have these kinds of things. It became a little bit more of an emotional manipulation and battle between the two of them, because she's just so crazy you can't really have an intellectual sparring match. It's not really a debate team kind of a pairing.
Right.
Because it's, no debate teams. Do you have someone suddenly leaping over the podium to, stab you in the neck or something? It just doesn't quite work. But I'd love to see him in an instance where, in order to either deal with his own internal struggles or deal with the question of where Gallifrey stands, that we get another one of these kind of a courtroom scenario sparring matches that allows him to just devour dialogue and really have so much fun with the characters, his passions, because he really is a very passionate doctor about things, but the way that he conveys it are ones that where you need to actually lean back in your chair, because you're rightfully scared of him when he gets that worked up.
Yeah.
But it comes from such a point of intelligence and such a point of inner conviction. I'm not going to say power or anything, because he's not necessarily a powerful character, but he's very strong in his conviction. So I'd love to see him have to do some sort of a defense of that sort of thing against. And I think it'd be kind of cool to bring the Valyard back personally. We're not done with that. I don't know. What would be your ideal situation to see them, or some aspects of Capaldi's Doctor that you'd like to see used more in the next series?
I mean, like I said, I want to see more of the introspective journey. I want to see more of the questioning himself kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, this series was so fantastic in laying out the Doctor as, this new version of the Doctor. I don't want to see him become too human. I think that's one of the things that needs to be a defining character of this Doctor, is the fact that he, regardless of how close he gets to people, because with most of the people that he comes in contact with, you give him enough time and he gets to the point where he accepts them.
Mm.
And that's fine. I'm okay with that, but he needs to keep that spiky demeanor at first. He needs to keep that, the unapproachability, up to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
If and when Clara winds up leaving, I want to see a struggle with the new companion. Yeah. I want to see somebody that understands, well, this person is important and I understand the importance of being with him, but God, I can't stand him sometimes,
mm-hmm.
I would love to see that kind of clash of personalities. Like you said, I want to see more of the intellectual battles with people, because, with Tennant and Smith, it was more about the spectacle. It was more about the, look how clever I am and look how amazing I can do. And I want to see more of the, I'm important because of my intelligence kind of thing. I can get out of this by, you know, using my intelligence and not needing to blow up a fleet of people behind someone just to deliver a message, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I would love to see that aspect.
I think there are some elements, that I think could benefit. And I know I don't want to jump ahead of companion assignments and things of that mm-hmm. sort. Or maybe it's something that we can kind of transition towards if Clara sticks around for another half a season or what have you. Mm-hmm. But it kind of goes along back to, Second Doctor and Jamie and then Second Doctor and Jamie Victoria. So, you know, there could be, a trio in the TARDIS, I think would work well mm-hmm. with this Doctor, as long as it is not a Pons kind of trio. This is a non-romantic. Right,
not a couple, but a, you know, some companions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think a male companion would be very beneficial for this Doctor because I think there are some aspects of his persona that have not had an opportunity to come to surface because his only real interaction with male characters that we've had were Danny and that had an undercurrent of the disdain for soldiers that ran throughout. So
yeah,
we got close with our engineer, where you could see that there was a sort of a spark there of appreciation. Yep.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, you'd definitely keep the female characters for, give the girl someone to relate to, give the guy someone to stare at, you know. But I definitely think that, yeah, a male companion would benefit this Doctor a lot more than any of the previous iterations we've gotten in Modern Who, really.
Mm.
I mean, I think the Jack and Doctor relationship was fun. But again, there, you know, even though the Doctor was clearly not interested, there was almost like that flirtation to it that had the underlying current.
All right. It's the perception filter gag, you know, not even realizing that you're really there. But no, I mean, I think the female companion is a necessary dynamic because of the fact, and it's viewership aside, it's really a matter of the fact that there are aspects to the male and female dichotomy, the two of them working together, where they are just going to observe different things. They're going to notice different things mm-hmm. that just two blokes might not see.
Oh yeah.
And I don't mean this in any sort of a sexist manner. And this is not in any way saying that, you know, guys don't pay attention to that stuff. That's not necessarily what I mean. It's a matter of just having the better cross section, within your character group, the more diverse that group is, the more capable they're going to be aware, cognizant, and able to adapt and respond to the situations that they get thrown into. We saw in Time Heist where you had, you know, the whole team assembled.
Yeah.
But you had the intellect, you had the savvy, you had the spy nature, you had the tank, you had the, you know,
the healer,
precisely. I mean, you ran the full character gamut there. And I think that the trio idea of having, you know, and the ages really don't necessarily matter to me. I've never really been one to say that, okay, I'd like to see both a male and a female companion right now, but the female has to be under the age of 35 and the male has to be somewhere 30 to 42 or something of that sort.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite, I've never really seen it to that degree, but knowing back historically, all those instances where you had a couple companions there. So there were moments when they would be able to go off and serve some part of the plot when the Doctor was doing some of his, you know, under the hood fiddlings. And so you had two teams going off to work on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they were both traveling companions and not just your companion and the character to be met in this episode.
Right.
There was something more to it. You know, whether it was Tegan and Nyssa or any of those sort of pairings, you know, just having the two sets.
It's a much better way to do the side-by-side storytelling kind of thing. You know, you've got your companion running off and doing their thing, but then you also have someone that the Doctor can still explain what he's doing to without, you know, expositionizing.
Right. I think it may also benefit what we're trying to figure out for the Doctor internally, because when you've got two companions off in the room and the Doctor's not there, they talk about him.
Yeah.
You know, this happened all the time before where you'd get the, you know, sort of the companions, a companion speaking to, you know, random human who has been bumped into over the course of this story. They're not going to go to any great lengths describing how the Doctor has been behaving lately or what's under his skin or what have you. But they'll talk to, you know, Amy and Rory would talk to each other about the Doctor or, you know, or what have you, because that's, they're on the inside. They can have that conversation and we as the viewers can be a part of it. So.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm curious as to whether or not we're going to keep Clara. I'm interested to see if it's going to be a transition instead of just a straight handoff when she does decide to leave. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, but I know that it's going to be a fun ride regardless.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go ahead and talk about some news that we got this week.
Yeah. Well, surprisingly, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff because at this point, you know, we're sort of midstream between the break and where the Christmas episode falls. So, you know, little bits about that offering are coming to light. You know, Stephen Moffat's doing a little talking as he likes to do.
Moffat-splaining. No. Well, let's go ahead and leave this first one till the end since that is spoiler territory.
Okay. But,
cool. So the next one that we've got here, Moffat says that the Christmas special is the strangest thing I've ever written. And this kind of worries me. I mean, it could be incredibly awesome. It could be problematic.
Well, you gotta take, and I know that we're gonna start mincing words here, but Moffat calling something strange could mean either it's him attempting to do a script style that he's never toyed with before, or that he's trying to use a storytelling technique that's unfamiliar to him, like writing the mystery back to front or what have you, or doing sort of a memento kind of a, you know, you get the end scene and then work your way backwards, which I don't know if they've ever done. Have they ever done a memento episode?
I don't think so. I mean, the closest that we've gotten is some of the, the wibbly wobbly kind of, things where, like, the Big Bang when, you know, the Doctor goes back to talk to Amy and you see the, where his jacket went in that one episode that we completely missed, you know?
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, so it could be something like that. So it could be him either playing with a new writing style or a new script gimmick. Or it could be him deciding that he's going to, because we're dealing with Kris Kringle and that sort of thing, that he's going to hand us something bizarre, some really bizarre take on the Christmas story.
Yeah.
Because one of the terms he uses in this interview is he calls it a claustrophobic adventure, which is a kind of specific choice of words that I think is more interesting than him saying it's going to be strange.
Yeah, I mean, because that says, or, you know, is it going to be a bottle episode? Is it, you know, there's lots of things that it could be, but, you know, that, I mean, typically bottle episodes have that name, you know, they're, people understand what a bottle episode is, so they typically use that, you know, that term. Mm-hmm.
Because he says, and I'll quote him here. He says, the people who think they might hate this won't hate it at all. And of all of the Christmas specials that I've done, it's the one most like the paradigm Doctor Who episode. So what does that necessarily mean? If we always sort of take the Christmas episodes and we put them on a separate shelf because they are, you know, they are atypical. Mm-hmm. They have their own behavior. They don't typically intrude on the plot development. They, you know, they're usually, rather cutesy with a threat that's very easily dispatched so that you can have your nice positive Christmas message and what have you. How do you apply that to what Stephen Moffat, of all people, calls the paradigm Doctor Who episode? How do they differ?
That's a very good question. I think that is probably something that we're not going to be able to figure out regardless.
Okay.
I think that when Moffat uses words like that, he's doing it specifically to make people question and sometimes throw people off. Other times he can be very good at saying exactly what it is you're supposed to be looking at, but because we're so used to looking at everything askew with him that we just completely miss that, no, this is the exact explanation. Mm. So,
well, I'm going to toss that out to the listeners there and ask for their suppositions, what they believe by the strangest episode. You know, what do you feel that actually describes? What would you consider to be a claustrophobic and tense episode that still involves a positive Christmas message? And then lastly, where would you go with the idea of saying that you're doing something different with a Christmas episode by applying it to the paradigm that it didn't have before? So
please give us some insight, because we're lost.
And I like being lost. I like, you know, not having any kind of assurance of to what I'm going to see. We have also obviously some of the new couple sets of new pictures released. You know, some stills from the episode. Nothing. I think these were all kind of posed shots for the most of them.
Yeah.
But we're seeing some of our ancillary characters. I don't see any real familiar. We do have Michael Trouton, who's going to be playing Professor Albert in this. And for those of you, if you were listening to the interviews that we were having with Fraser Hines, he was saying that Michael is very much like his father in a lot of regards. You know, they've used him in Big Finish for a lot of the audio work and such. So I love seeing this sort of extended family of who kind of pulled back in. But I'm not really, as far as some of the other characters that have been handed to us here, Maureen Beatty, playing Bellows. We've got a young actress, Natalie Gomede, and these all look like, looking at their outfits and things, I'm not really sure if they're supposed to be, I wonder if they're like back in, you know, North Pole headquarters kind of things. You know, they're wearing their, fleece vests and whatnot.
Yeah. But I don't know.
But of course, and then you've got, you know, Dan Starkey and things as one of our elves, you know, wearing the least amount of prosthetics I think he's had in the show in decades.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be interesting. I mean, good or not, I don't know, but it looks like it'll at least have an interesting storyline to it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, the whole idea of the fact that, as Nick Frost had been quoted as saying, that this is something having to do with a long-standing beef between the Doctor and Santa. They don't outright hate one another, but there's some turmoil in the past. So let's see where they go with this.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but then we actually did get a confirmed airtime for The Last Christmas. So it will be coming on at 6:15 East or 6:15 PM. In the UK.
Right. So, which, again, I guess because of the nature of some of the other stuff that they've got running, their time signatures across this series have been all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, some of them running as late as 8 o'clock or even later local time there. And, you know, this one, you know, I know they often do things like 10 after the hour and so forth, but 6:15, when the only thing preempting it is just Strictly Come Dancing. There's no reason for that particularly, unless that's coming into a finale or something in their competition that it has to run. I think it normally ran an hour, but they've got it slated for like an hour and 15 for some reason. So something must be happening in that riveting program.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I want to know. Yeah. That's definitely going to be what I pay attention to before.
Precisely.
But yeah. And then it's got a standard running time of 60 minutes, which is typical for the Christmas special. So.
Right.
So, but then a little bit of non-news here, and this is slightly terrifying. Apparently, Microsoft has started making Daleks. They have actually robots which can very easily resemble Daleks if you look at them right. And these things are set up with all kinds of sensors and AI and things like that. And in one shot, it actually looks like they have the trademark plunger kind of thing. So, but these are actually patrolling the Microsoft campus.
Yeah. These are their security droids, so to speak.
Yeah.
Labeled as the K5s because they couldn't dare call them the K9s.
I was going to say they've got four more iterations to get it down to dog size.
Right. Exactly. and no, they've confirmed that there are no ray guns, currently, applied to them.
Currently.
But again, at this current iteration, as they are, you know, 5 units into their development, you can still avoid them by just going up a flight of stairs. So
yeah,
you got that going for you.
We haven't got to, what was it, like season 17 yet?
Elevate status.
I just saw this down. This has been updated since I added it to the news. Microsoft is using these, but they're actually constructed by Nightscope and temporarily deployed at Microsoft's campus as part of a demonstration. So, so it's not Microsoft. Microsoft is just the power behind Davros. So
yeah, that's all.
There we go.
Now, I guess we'll call the next, 2 minutes here. Put the spoiler bookends on this. So, yep.
So if you want to skip it, go ahead.
I mean, it's not, I don't really know how spoilery I would call this.
Well, just for people that want to stay completely, spoiler free, if you don't want to know what Moffat has to say about the possibility of Missy returning, then, go ahead.
Or not returning.
Well, I said possibility of her returning. It could be that he's saying, no, she's absolutely done. So way to ruin it.
I didn't. So, okay.
No, totally didn't give the answer away there.
Headphones on. Okay. So she's unzappable. Yeah. That's all I'm taking away from this.
Yeah. He actually said that she is unzappable.
Yeah. The master is never dead, no matter what happens to him or her. So
which we knew this. I mean, this is, you can never really kill the master, but specifically, Moffat has said that he has asked Michelle Gomez to come back as Missy.
Right.
So we will see this iteration of the master again, which I know I'm incredibly excited about, because you can't just give her 2 episodes and expect us all to be okay.
Yes. You need the rest of the fruit salad to go along with the bananas.
Exactly.
So when she gets into full mangoes mode, then it's all over. Because I mean, we were already at the point where we were analyzing, well, that, was that a gray zap, or was it a blue laser zap, or was it a red laser zap? So red means uploaded. No, blue means uploaded. Red means vaporized. Wait,
yeah, exactly.
No.
And, at this point, it's like, you're going to have people to get hung up on that, but I'm just happy that she's coming back. I don't care how they try and explain it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I still want to know, where did you get the Matrix time slice?
Yeah. Oh, well, there's still plenty of questions, which actually, next week, that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about the questions that are still unanswered at the end of Series 8.
We will not be providing answers.
Oh, absolutely not.
In fact, you may walk away from this, 45 minutes to an hour later with more questions than you came into it, but that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, so if you want to come and listen to us be frustrated about questions that you've put on a shelf and are okay with and wind up frustrated about them again, come back and listen next week.
Yeah, add your harumphs, because I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Oh, yeah, so hopefully Haley will be better next week and we'll actually get her back, so... But until then, this has been episode 115 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, look at the eyebrows. They're fantastic eyebrows.
How formidable. And this is Kier saying, suck it up, Mally.
We'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, we'll see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.